Welcome to Piano Inspires podcast, celebrating pianists, teachers, and innovators as they share their inspiring stories about the transformative power of music.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today. My name is Dr. Luis Sanchez. I'm professor of piano at Texas A&M University of Commerce, and I serve as director of international engagement for the Francis Clark Center. And I'm delighted to have Dr. Susy Garcia as our guest today. Professor Emeritus Susana Garcia joined the faculty of the University of Louisiana School of Music in August 1990. She held the Louisiana Board of Regents Ruth Stothill Girard Endowed Professorship from 2000 to 2021, and for many years, she served as the coordinator of keyboard studies and as scholarship coordinator for the School of Music. She performs regularly with pianist William Chapman Niajo as the Niajo-Garcia Piano Duo, specializing in both the standard repertoire and newly composed works for piano duo and duets. She is the co-developer of innovative piano, multimedia resources for developing musician skills, a sequenced multimedia curriculum for piano instruction that includes instructional videos, video animations, original compositions, and pedagogical editions of standard piano works. In 2021, Innovative Piano was awarded the MTNA Francis Clark Award for Keyboard Pedagogy. Susy, I'm so delighted to spend this time with you today.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to do this and be here with you.
Fantastic. So I thought we could have a conversation about your career, and maybe we can go back in time to the early years. And how did music play a role in your childhood?
Well, you know, my parents were immigrants, and my father came from Mexico, and he came to Texas as a child, and eventually went to medical school at the University of Texas, Galveston, and was a doctor, and then joined the Army in World War II, where he was, among many places he was stationed, was in Naples, Italy, where he met my mother, Wanda Fusillo, and they married, and they came back to Corpus Christi, Texas, where he set up his medical practice. That's a long story, but he loved Mexican music. So in our household, we listened to a lot of border type music, mariachi music. He loved Cuban the band leaders, you know, that era of band leaders, and so we had recordings. All kinds of interesting Latin-type recordings. My mother, on the other hand, was a classical pianist and a very, very good one. And so we also heard, she loved Rubinstein. She loved Rubinstein's playing. And so we had a lot of Rubinstein records. We had Horowitz records. But really, it was Rubinstein that I grew up listening to, that, you know, that great romantic style of playing. And she played also quite a bit. Then I, as the youngest child, I had my oldest sister was loving that era of music before rock and roll, you know, right before Elvis. So she, you know, she had all the Frank Sinatra and the, you know, that the crooner era. And then my other sister, right above me, was right there with the rock and roll era. And so we had the Beatles and then Motown. Ooh. What a change, you know. So I got it all. We were all listening to music, and we all listened to different kinds of music. And I think that's so important when you, you know, in a family, is to have music be part of that environment. Because I am sure that my mother, I'm sure that her influence on me was very great as to be a pianist. But my openness to all kinds of repertoire and to all styles of music really came from those very early years.
Wonderful. Music had such an integral part of the household.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't think it was conscious. You know, I don't think anybody was saying, there. We need to listen to music so our children will be educated. It wasn't like that. It was just the household.
How about piano lessons? When did those start? Do you have memories of your first piano teacher, perhaps?
My first piano teacher was my mother.
I thought so, right?
For better or worse. No, but my mother was, She was a you know, I don't know much about her piano education, but what I did as a very small child was a lot of technique. She had me playing not Hannon, but patterns like that that were building my fingers. But I was probably four. Wow. You know, I have pictures of myself at the piano from the time I was three. And I don't remember learning songs from her, but I sure do remember those technical drills. And I think that really built a lot of my, you know, a lot of my physical dexterity, you know, which I'm right. quite proud of. You know, I can get around. And I think it came from that. And then when I went to school, I went to Catholic school, and there was a nun that taught piano and asked me if I wanted piano lessons, and I said I did. And so that was my teacher for until I graduated from high school. And so those are my early lessons, and I don't remember much about her, except it always struck me that she was 150 years old for like the longest time. But she, I remember I struggled with reading. I have a very good ear, and I struggled with reading, and it was very easy for me to learn what I was being taught because I could remember it.
Right.
And then when I was looking at the music, since I could already remember it, I was only using the physical music as a reinforcement for what I already remembered. So, and then that's a whole other story, the struggles with reading. But, you know, those are my first
your
memories.
First memories of music. And when did you feel you got that call? Like, oh, this is the path I want to follow.
From listening to those Rubinstein recordings. So I mean, it was immediate. I mean, I don't remember ever not thinking I would be a pianist. Mm-hmm. I don't remember that. I always just... knew.
So that's
I loved
how strong
I loved
that influence
it.
Was for you.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was my mother or Rubinstein. I'm not sure. Or both.
Oh, both, right?
Or both. But there was never a moment later when I went, oh, this is what I want to do. I just...
Very organic.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Did you face any challenges in those days and with this career path that you have chosen?
Well, I think that I mentioned the struggles with reading, and it was an odd experience. This is one of the struggles I experienced because I was very quick at everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, I was very precocious academically, and I was reading and doing math and doing all the things that I was doing this very early. But doggone it, I couldn't figure out how notation worked. I could do all these really complicated things very easily with no effort. So something about being challenged like that, I think while it might discourage people, it helped me because I was used to things coming very easily and reading really wasn't coming easily. But I think that kind of, I enjoyed having something that didn't come easily, you know? So my teacher tried different things and I remember this when we switched to whatever I was using to the music tree.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was in the 60s, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's when I was going to primary school. And it was a revelation, you know? And so that whole Francis Clark intervallic approach really was, it helped me survive. Reading really never became easy for me until much later in life. And now I consider myself a decent reader, but not a great reader. And I'm saying this to encourage other people who may experience difficulties with any aspect of their music making that shouldn't keep you from aspiring to a life in music just because your reading is slow or because if you're trying to learn to play by ear, you're having trouble. You know, you shouldn't make life decisions based on the fact that you're a troubled reader.
Right.
That was my main challenge.
The main challenge. But you turned it into something that kind of ignited more energy just to move forward. And
well, yeah, it did.
It, right?
It did. And it helped me move forward, but I think it really made me a better teacher. Once I started teaching, I was able to recognize the similar difficulties Because, you know, not reading well can have a variety of reasons.
True.
And if you've ever struggled with anything, you're better able to detect the subtle reasons. You know, it may be this, but it may be this. And I think coming from that background of struggle, it helped me all kinds of ways.
Wonderful. So once you move on to college and you started your college career, and what influences you receive at that time that push you forward in your path?
I think the strongest influence for me was just my desire. And then that was supported by just one after the other of really great teachers. Teachers who really nurtured me, helped me with stuff that I did poorly, chastised me when I was lazy. I think that I was very lucky to have really great teachers. And I think that the combination of personal drive and a good work ethic, you know, face it, you got
to
work.
You have to.
You got
to
work. And then the environments, I was in very positive collegiate environments. So
you mentioned your mother and Rubinstein as inspirations, mm-hmm. or when your early childhood. What about later in life? Did you find other people that were inspiration to you?
Yeah, I think once you are working professionally, once you're in a job situation or you're out in the real world, you rely less on recorded models. You know, mm-hmm. because you have real people and yes. they're influencing you in all kinds of ways. And I'll go back to my teachers, but I'll also throw in the mix different people I've worked with, colleagues, collaborators. And I'm a real team person. You know,
right.
And as you know, I play with William Chapman Yahoo. We've been playing together since 1991.
Wow.
So, yes. And then I have Chanquette Lim, who is my partner in Innovative Piano. You know, my whole career has been about partnerships. And I find inspiration from the partnership, from that model. And whoever I'm working with, if it's another musician in a chamber music setting, or if it's another scholar that I might be doing some research with, I just am inspired by that other person. And you know, I think
that's
when
wonderful.
You collaborate, what you appreciate is not just the person, but the third person who is the composite of the two of you. So I've always said this about Nyaho and our duo, that there's Nyaho, and there's me, and there's the duo.
The two of you. Mm-hmm.
And that's separate inspirations. And so if you are somebody who wants to collaborate and get that kind of inspiration, I would really encourage that, because, you know, one person's great. You're great. You've got your own ideas, but man, you can just get so much more from the second and the third person, you know, the composite of the two. So I would say that I can't point to a single famous artist, you know. I can point to many teachers who really nurtured me. I could point to but I would say that continuing on, you know, in your life, it's important to have people all the time that challenge you and challenge you to greatness and challenge your weaknesses, challenge your mistake, boneheaded thinking.
Absolutely.
You know, so.
So, and if we don't look at individuals, you know, that inspire us, but music itself, what kind of music inspires you?
Oh. You know, I'm still like that little kid growing up in Corpus Christi, Texas. If you were to look at my CD, I still have LPs. I have a lot of LPs, and I listen to them. If you were to look at my, you know, music collection, you would find everything under the sun. And I'm inspired by all of it. You know what I'm really inspired? I'm inspired by creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And if I hear, well, we heard a great concert with Sarah Davis Buchner the other
Beautiful.
Night, where you could not imagine a more creative interpretation of this music that we've heard, much of which we've been hearing many, many times, but it was like hearing it through new ears. That was so inspiring to me. And it was not the music itself. I mean, the music's wonderful. I love, you know, how could you not love those pieces? The music's wonderful, but it was seeing her really creative and unique take on familiar things that you've never even really thought could ever be different than the way you
heard them forever.
Yeah, heard them forever. And I mean, that to me was like what I want to do in all my work, whether it's performance or whether it's, you know, I'm doing some research on Thomas Kerr right now. Whatever it is I'm doing, I want to approach it with that creativity. So when I listen to other kinds of music, you know, I love the creativity of Paul Simon as a pop artist who I've been following his career since, you know, early days of Simon and Garfunkel. And I will always, if he's got something new to say, I want to hear it. And people like that. So it's the creative impulse that inspires me. And it doesn't matter what style of music it is.
Beautiful. So let's fast forward to Susie today. And you're involved in so many wonderful things. You with the innovative piano, with your work with Niaho. How are you or your work changing our world?
Well, it helps to be retired from your from your academic job.
I was wondering that too.
Right? I was going to say, you know, when you're working a full-time academic job, you're commitment is to that job. I mean, that's your obligation. That's your responsibility. Your work is should be about your students, nurturing them, giving them what they need to be successful in whatever they do, whether it's music or they change their majors and go to psychology. You know, you still are there
part of that
to nurture that, and you're helping to build the school, to build the reputation of the school, to build the support your colleagues. At the school that I retired from, University of Louisiana at Lafayette, that music school has a phenomenally collegial and supportive culture, which is one reason I stayed there my whole career, is because I could thrive. And the faculty, the middle administration, the upper administration, I just had support all the time. And you don't hear that said very much.
It's true, yeah.
And so it was a good place to work, but all my efforts really were on my obligations to the student and, frankly, building my resume as a young, you know, professor. I had to have resume
exactly
items, yeah. And I always chose projects that I was interested in. I never did anything just to do it, you know, just for the resume item. So when I retired in 2021 in May, I thought I had all the time in the world to take on all these projects, you know. Right. So I took on kind of a lot of projects. But I will say that I'll start with the Innovative Piano for just a second, because it is a business. It's a group piano multimedia curriculum, and it's a business that grew out of two teachers that wanted to improve their students' experiences. Group piano is hard. It's hard for college music majors because they have to get proficiency in something fast that they may have had no experience in. And that's a big ask, you know? Mm-hmm. And we were not satisfied with the progress our students were making towards proficiency. I mean, they could pass their proficiency, but we didn't really feel like they were really proficient, like if they could leave the group piano classroom and use piano as a tool professionally as needed. They didn't have
which is the goal, right?
Which is the goal. The goal isn't the proficiency. Yeah. You know, the goal is, okay, you're a band director and you need to plunk, or a choir director, you need to plunk out parts.
Yes.
You need to be able to read a score. You need to, maybe you're a music therapist and you need some keyboard skill, you know.
Yes.
You need these skills. So we just started making materials that we thought, videos and audio tracks that we thought would help. This wasn't about starting a business. There's nothing about the business. And so we started And we'd post them on our LMS, right? And we just started noticing real progress quick, and also a much higher motivation level. Students were having a sense of fun. You know, they were enjoying the process.
Yeah, right.
And they were more engaged. So we took these first, I don't know, five videos that we made to a conference. And people said, where can I get, how can I get these videos?
Right.
You know, so we thought, okay, well, maybe we should commercialize it. So we did, and it's been a long process. But mm-hmm. That's Innovative Vienna really grew out of a need to serve our students. And to me, serving your students is changing. I mean, I think we have to remember that.
Yes.
That's what we're doing.
Yes.
If I'm creating more ease for someone who's going to be a music professional to go out and do a better job more easily, I see that as changing the world. That's changing the world like one by one.
Right.
Which is important.
Yes, of course.
But then the other projects, and this is why I love working with the Francis Clark Center, because the Francis Clark Center has a really global vision. The Francis Clark Center wants to make big changes, you know? So it's great to be doing the one-to-one change, but I also like being associated with an organization that's trying to do things in a bigger way. So my other current project is researching the music of Thomas Henderson Kerr Jr., who... if you don't know his name when you're listening to this podcast, I hope you will in
right.
another year.
Yes.
So briefly, Thomas Henderson Kerr Jr. was an African-American composer who died in the 1980s. He was a professor at Howard University for mostly his whole career. Well, he composed a lot of pieces, piano works, choral works, organ works. He was also an organist. And none of his piano works, and very few, just maybe two of his organ works are appearing in an anthology, but none of his piano works have been published. All his music and his papers are in 14 boxes in the Schomburg Center for Black Cultural Studies in New York City. And the story of how I came to be interested in Thomas Kerr is too long to tell, but a manuscript came to Niaho's in my mm-hmm. inboxes.
Right.
From somebody who had a 20,000 times Xerox version of this two piano piece. And so we learned it.
Right.
And we loved it, and we've been, it's on our latest CD, but we've been touring with it. And it's a concert scherzo based, a set of variations based on the Negro spiritual, Didn't My Lord Deliver Daniel. It's a fantastic piece.
It is.
It's a fantastic piece. Where has it been? It was
right.
It's written in 1940, and it's in a box. And we just, so the crime here to me is that if there hadn't been this accidental email,
right?
Now, nobody would have, this piece would be completely forgotten.
True.
To history.
Sad, yes.
So this is how I feel like I'm trying to change the world anyway. Not just bringing this piece to light, but with the Francis Clark Center, who is going to publish this piece, we're going to also publish two more of his piano works. But that's, to me, a huge accomplishment. But what I want to inspire others to do is to understand that there's boxes like this in every archive, in every library, all over the world.
Waiting to be discovered.
And, you know, and there's reasons this music wasn't published, which I'm not going to go into. And I'm not even sure what the reasons are. I could just kind of guess. but I don't know for sure. But I am going to promise you that there are going to be dozens, if not hundreds, of African-American composers whose music has never been published. And this is why history is important. And this is why honesty about history is important. You know, and I do think it's important to know why the music wasn't published. I'm just not able to say for sure why that was. But I think that's part of the research process. And I hope if you're a young pianist or a young scholar hearing this podcast and looking for a topic for your doctoral work
to direct your attention to.
You know?
Yes.
Just going into these libraries and cataloging what's in there for the world to see would be changing the world and being truthful and honest about music history and about, for African Americans, that experience in the United States. And I think that history is a little bit under attack right now. And I'm going to be the first one to say history is what keeps us moving forward as a people, as a culture, as Americans. You know, history is what keeps us grounded and tied to our past and gives us the ability to move, have a future that is equitable.
That's wonderful. Thank you for that. Yes. So you have been so impactful in your career. You continue to be so impactful in our profession, in the world, with your career. What advice would you have to young professionals as they look for their path, look for their niche in our profession?
You know, I had a conversation with Martha Hilly. I'm sure she doesn't remember this, but I'm going to tell this story because it didn't come early in my career, but it came much later in my career when I was offered associate dean position at my school. And I'd been a professor there for many years. And it wasn't anything that I had to interview for. I was just being offered it. And I thought, oh, well, you know, that's kind of cool. But, you know, and I wasn't really sure because I love teaching.
Right.
Teaching is what I'm
Your
really,
passion,
well,
right?
my passion. Now, I think I'd have really great administrator skills. I've just, my personality, you know, I think I'd be a great administrator because I'm organized. I listen to people, you know, but I really, that's not my passion. I might have great administrator skills, but so what? I
right.
love
mm-hmm.
to teach. So anyway, I called up Martha Hilly, who, you know, is my long time and continuing mentor and a really important person in my life. And I, you know, and she had been an associate dean briefly at the
right.
University of Texas.
Yes.
And I called her up and I told her the deal. And she said, well, darling, have you just always wanted to be an administrator? That was all she said.
Right.
And I knew right then, no. You know, it never crossed my mind that I wanted to be an administrator. I am not knocking administrators. A good administrator is a beautiful thing. I'm not knocking it. But her point was, is that like what you always wanted
your calling,
to do?
Right?
Is that your calling?
Right.
And I knew immediately that I had to say no to this job. And I did. And she, although that didn't come early in my career, that is a path that I always followed, was my own, I hate to use the word passion because it's almost overused. What's your passion,
right.
you know?
Yes.
But that is what it was. I've always followed my passion. I had, I came from a family. So my father, yeah, back to my father, the doctor. My father, the doctor, was an immigrant from Mexico, and he had 7 siblings. There were 8 children in this family. 7 of the 8 children, male and female, became medical doctors.
Wow.
Which is, I mean, that's got to be some
yes.
kind of statistic.
It's a record,
that's
right?
That's got to
yes.
go in the Guinness Book. Immigrants yes. from Mexico, 7 of 8 siblings, male and female, became medical doctors. So guess what I was expected to be
right. mm-hmm.
when I was, you know, getting to the age of making decisions like that. There was enormous pressure on me to be a doctor. And because I was strong academically, that was a real expectation. You know, I would go to med, I would be, have good grades, I would test well, and I would go to medical school, and that would be my path. And
right.
and because my father was, and my mother too, but my father understood that women needed to be independent. That was something that was just beat into us. You know, you're not to expect a spouse to take care of you. You know, that's not your goal in life, is to be completely independent and to do something that you could be your own person, which is pretty advanced for the
right.
early 1970s, right? So they were completely opposed. Mm. My parents, well, not my mother, because she was a pianist.
Sure, yes.
But my father and his siblings were completely opposed to my doing what I wanted to do. But I hung to it, and I did it. And I have been very happy in my work. So if I were to advise people, I would say to be true to yourself. I heard somebody talking at one of the sessions yesterday about, you know, you can, no, this wasn't a session, this was with a friend, who said, you can do what you want and be happy. You can make a lot of money and be happy. You can make a lot of money and be miserable because you're not doing what you want, you know. So your first consideration should be what's going to make you happy, what's going to sustain you through your entire life, not make a decision based on whether you can get a job or not. And I'm not saying that's not important. I'm just not saying that. I'm saying that that can't be the only equation.
Yes.
You have to do doing something that you are miserable in will not result in a long life. It won't result in good health. Mm-hmm. It won't result in emotional happiness. Mm-hmm. It'll affect your relationships. It'll affect everything you do. So try to find a way to make a living.
Yes.
Doing what you love.
What you love.
And that would be my advice.
That's beautiful advice. That's beautiful advice. So throughout our chat today, we talked about inspirations, people, music. But how about the piano? How does the piano inspire you?
The piano as an instrument, or the,
yes,
yeah, well, of course, I had this love from a very small, very early age, but I think this is something people don't say enough. You know, when we got into this digital piano age, and there's all this discussion about digital pianos replace acoustic pianos, and what should our students play, and all that stuff. I'm not getting into any of that. I'm just going to say that. What I love, the piano talks to me. When I play the piano, it talks back. and it isn't just the sound. It's the feel. It's when you play, a piano, it vibrates.
The vibration,
I mean, there's a whole tactile, I don't mean just, tactile because I'm using my fingers. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a real sensory connection that I feel to the instrument. That you can't get on a digital keyboard.
You cannot,
I'm so
right?
sorry. I mean, I'm not even talking about the quality of the sound. I'm just talking about the physicality of the instrument. And I find that almost like a relationship. That's really important. So there's that piece. And the other piece is we live in a very troubled world. And maybe we always have lived in a very troubled world. I mean, I remember during the 1980s, and I was probably in my 20s, right? We were so expecting a nuclear war to happen. We were expecting an arms race with Russia. I mean, that was going to result in a nuclear bomb. And a lot of us really believed that we wouldn't survive. I mean, that was like the way we talk about climate change now is kind of similar. We're worried about our survival. Well, let me tell you, we were worried about our survival in the 1980s. So maybe nothing has changed. Maybe there's always these periods where human beings have to face the reality that we may not be here forever. Then there's all kinds of other, things, which I won't go into. But I have found that whenever I start to get really have that hopeless feeling, which I'm having more and more these days because there's just so much hatred and
bombarded.
Yeah, we're constantly bombarded by hatred. And then the wonderful, wonderful power of social media that is just being used for horrible ends. I love technology. I'm not scared of technology. And I think it has the power to do wonderful things, but it also has the power to do terrible things. So I just find whenever I get that way, I pick a new piece of music to learn.
Healing,
I know. Especially, it's always going to be chamber music because I'm going to find somebody who wants to play this with me, So this was a long way around of saying something very basic, which is I like to lose myself in a new piece. And I mean, an old piece doesn't do it. It has to be a new piece.
A new piece.
Something that I really want to play. Something that I love. Something that resonates with me. You know, a Brahms quartet, a Brahms trio. Something that I just, you know, you can just
sticks to you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it really helps. It elevates my, well, first place, it distracts me. But the other piece of it is that it elevates my mood. The third thing is it puts, because it's collaborative, it puts me in touch with other human beings. And I mean, I'm already, it's not like I'm isolated. I mean, it's just a different way. It's a different way to interact.
Around, yes.
So I think I'm so grateful that I can play the piano, you know? And I'm not even saying I'm grateful that I'm a professional. I'm just so grateful that I can play the piano and that I have that to keep me going in a dark time. If times aren't dark, it still keeps you going. It keeps you going because it's, you know, it's all about the joy. It's all about the joy either way. It's just that sometimes we have more of a need to be kept. We have a need to be positive, you know, and yes. It helps me.
This has been a wonderful time with you.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you, Luis.
And I hope everybody tunes in for other podcasts and we'll keep in touch.
Thank you so very much.
The Francis Clark Center is a not-for-profit educational organization that serves the advancement of piano teaching, learning, and performing. Divisions include Piano Magazine, Piano Inspires Kids, Journal for Piano Research, National Conference on Keyboard Pedagogy, the New School for Music Study, Piano Education Press, International Online Teacher Education, and Piano Inspires Online Community Hub. Please visit us at pianoinspires.com to learn more about our impactful work and inspiring community.